What's next for Dreamers in Illinois? More than 40,000 of them could face deportation after the Trump administration says it's ending the DACA program. Now it's up to Congress to do something. Illinois Senator Dick Durbin first introduced the DREAM Act 16 years ago, and this morning he called on Congress and the president to act.
So I stand here with the confidence that these Dreamers and their courage, their families and their courage are behind us. And now it's time for us, members of the House and Senate, to summon the courage and to fight for them and pass the DREAM Act.
Plus, with Hurricanes Harvey and Irma, along with the wildfires on the West Coast, how to talk to kids about natural disasters, and an Illinois company is working on a bionic hand that isn't just for the rich.
I just wanted to make sure that the stuff that we were doing was going to help the people who needed it around the world.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Yesterday, Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced that the Trump administration will end the program that allows nearly 800,000 people who were brought to the U.S. illegally as children to live and work here. It's called DACA. That stands for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. Illinois has the largest population in the Midwest of young people who qualified for the program. The Attorney General's office says that our state has the third highest number of approved initial applicants for the program. It was created by President Obama 5 years ago through an executive order. So we're talking about 42,000 or so residents here in Illinois. It allowed some of those who qualified to apply for and receive protection from being deported, along with the ability to work in the U.S. all on a 2-year basis. Now the Trump administration says the program will end in 6 months. He's leaving it up to Congress, he says, to work out the details. I'm joined now first by Nancy Ramirez Blancas. She's a senior at the University of Illinois. She's also president of ICAUS. That stands for the Illinois Coalition Assisting Undocumented Students Education. She's in our Urbana studios. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. Thank you.
So, Nancy, you're a senior. You're studying psychology and pre-law. And I know that for yourself and for many others who have been paying attention to this issue, this was the big fear when President Trump was elected that he'd end the DACA program. Did yesterday's announcement surprise you?
It did. But at the same time, I feel like we were prepared for it. Days prior to the initial announcement, there was a lot of information being put out there that, you know, kind of initially told us, you know, what to expect and how to prepare for it. It did come as a surprise. We were hoping that, you know, it wouldn't come down to that at the end, really.
And so you were brought to Illinois when you were one, and you're currently covered under DACA, right? When does your protection expire?
My protection will probably expire around July 2019. I just recently did my renewal, so I just recently got my permit in July of this year.
And so when you said that yesterday and over the past couple of months, people have been passing out around information, what kind of information? I imagine these are attorneys that are passing out information. What kind of things are people telling you?
It was definitely what to do if DACA ends. And so it really emphasized our rights as humans, as individuals here in the United States. It emphasized, you know, what we should focus next, what should we prepare. For a lot of people that might lose their DACA, finding other options when it comes to seeking work or going to school.
So, Nancy, I mentioned you're the president of ICAUS. That's a coalition that helps with undocumented students' education. What are other students on campus at the University of Illinois, maybe those who have DACA, or in the past we've spoken to students at the U of I who couldn't afford to apply for DACA? What are you hearing from students right now who are Dreamers?
A lot of the fears that we have now is what would happen to our jobs. We depend on, some of us work up to 2 jobs just to pay our rent, do our daily living skills, but at the same time also to cover some of the expenses that tuition has for students. And so, you know, losing that livelihood is definitely the top fear among all students right now in campus. And, you know, just figuring out what would happen with those fellowships, those graduate assistantships, those jobs or RA positions. And so, I mean, this really starts, you know, we really start now planning on what's going to happen next with that.
Yeah. Nancy, do you work while you're on campus also? Do you have a job?
I do. I work as a recovery specialist for Rosecrans Health Network. And, you know, it's just, I've been working there for the past year, and it really is kind of in what I love to do. I mean, it's up my alley with psychology. And so, I mean, I'm kind of saddened at the fact that I might have to leave that in the future.
That's Nancy Ramirez Blancas. She's a University of Illinois senior. As she said, she's studying psychology and pre-law. You know, people often use the terms DACA and DREAMer interchangeably, but they're different programs. DACA was created by President Obama through executive action 5 years ago. In 2012, when President Obama announced his decision to create the program, he referenced the DREAM Act and Congress's inability to pass it into law. The DREAM Act's roots actually all stem from here in Illinois. It was first introduced by Illinois Senator Dick Durbin 16 years ago. He was inspired by the story of a young Chicago musical prodigy from South Korea, Teresa Lee. The act would create a path to permanent residency for immigrants who were brought here illegally as children. That's how the young people the DREAM Act were meant to protect became known as DREAMers. In the few years after it failed to pass, Senator Durbin has introduced forms of the DREAM Act three more times. None of them have made it entirely through the Congress. It's passed the House and the Senate, but never at the same time. This morning, in a news conference with House and Senate Democrats, Senator Durbin told the story of how DREAMers weren't as vocal as they are now.
When I introduced the DREAM Act and I would go to audiences in Chicago with Jan Schakowsky and Robin Kelly and Luis Gutierrez, and we would talk about the DREAM Act, the students would listen and nod their heads. I would go outside to my car, and in the darkness, as I went to get in my car, standing next to it would be two or three young people. They would look in both directions, and they would say to me very quietly, "Senator, I'm a dreamer." The reason they whispered it was because they had been raised by their families to be extremely careful. Never let anyone know who you are, where you are, that you're undocumented. That's what their first reaction was. But did you notice what happened next? The dreamers started standing up, showing the kind of courage that all of us hope we can muster today. They stood up and said, "We are dreamers and we're proud of it. And we want to tell you who we are."
Congress has until March to act before the DACA program formally ends. If it does nothing, many DACA recipients could get deported once their two-year permits expire. Senator Durbin this morning called on his colleagues to take up the DREAM Act one more time and to pass it now before, in his words, it's too late to protect DREAMers.
I started going to the floor of the Senate with color photographs over 100 times to tell the stories of these DREAMers, and each one of those stories really made the case for why we need to make sure that justice is served when it comes to DACA and the DREAM Act. So I stand here with the confidence that these dreamers and their courage, their families and their courage, are behind us. And now it's time for us, members of the House and Senate, to summon the courage and to fight for them and pass the DREAM Act. Are we ready to do that?
Yeah.
Of course we are.
That's Senator Dick Durbin speaking this morning from the Capitol in Washington. We're talking about the announcement yesterday by Attorney General Jeff Sessions that the Trump administration has decided to end DACA, the program for deferred action for childhood arrivals. My guests are Nancy Ramirez Blancas. She's a senior at the University of Illinois. I also want to bring Mike Jarecki into the conversation. He's a Chicago-based immigration attorney. He's also with the Chicago chapter of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. And you, if you have questions or comments, you're always welcome to join us. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show, that's 21ST Show, with your comments or reaction. Nancy, as you heard Senator Durbin this morning talking about the fact that 15 years ago, 16 years ago, of course, you were really young then. you were what, like three or four at that point, maybe, when all of this was happening. Now I feel like you're very vocal. You're out there, as are tens of thousands of other people. So I guess the question for you is, what's your plan now? What do you want legislators to know? What are you going to be doing?
So right now, we want we want, you know, legislators to know that, you know, that especially for students here at the university, that our chances for success should not depend on status or citizenship. And so we really want people to, you know, call your local congressman district and ask them to pass legislation that would protect DACA students nationwide. And at the same time, we do want a permanent solution to this situation. We are aware that, you know, with the coming end of DACA, you know, we really have no other place to go. This is where we were raised. We, in essence, are Americans, and we want to belong, and we want to be part of this nation.
Yeah, thanks for that, Nancy. Michael, let's go to you first. I think maybe we should talk about the fact that DACA was always sort of meant to be a temporary program. I wonder, from your perspective, how many you think DACA recipients are likely maybe to even qualify for other permanent immigration status?
That's correct. And good morning. Thank you for having me on the show. We celebrated the 5-year anniversary this past summer, and as you said, it was always meant to be temporary. It was to be a fix for the now 800,000 individuals who are the most sympathetic of the undocumented immigrant population. These are individuals who have lived in the United States since childhood, many of them as infants. Many of them don't know any other home country but the United States. So as non-for-profits, as immigration attorneys and community groups were screening DACA applicants since 2012, there was always a push to see if any of those individuals would qualify for more immigration benefits, something more permanent. So that's something that's been ongoing, and that's going to be a push that happens between now and March 2018 to ensure that if at the time somebody applied, maybe they didn't have any path to permanent benefits, some intervening event has happened, some life event has changed, those individuals may qualify for more permanent benefits, and we want to make sure that we start the application process for those. An example would be a marriage. Many individuals who are living in the United States, their lives continue on, they have jobs, they meet people. If they're married to a U.S. citizen, it might be that those individuals have a path forward through a marriage-based filing. And there are many other different routes of things that need to be evaluated, and that's why individuals, as they're speaking with immigration counsel, they need to make sure that they have a competent individual who's licensed and not somebody who's just going to take advantage of them in this vulnerable time.
Yeah, so I was going to ask you what your advice is for people who are affected directly by this.
Yeah, I mean, with any sort of vulnerable period of time, people are going to be searching for answers, and they're going to be searching for answers of what they want to hear. And I think it's extremely important that people plug into community groups that are trusted, attorneys who might have reviews that are trusted, or individuals referred by family members, because there are a lot of individuals, unfortunately, who might engage in consumer fraud and want to promise individuals a path forward when there is no path forward. So I think being educated is the number one possible thing as to what are the trusted sources. I think at the University of Illinois, they're probably going to have plenty of places where students could, you know, ask, especially the student groups on campus, what are the trusted organizations to go to? Who are the trusted attorneys to go to? And those are the paths that people should follow. In Chicago, there's many non-for-profits that are going to have community groups and screenings during the week on weekends, and that's going to come forth, especially in this next month, where sort of pedal is to the metal, so to speak, because any individual who has a work authorization card that's expiring between now and March 5th, 2018, can still renew their DOC application and their work authorization, which would give them an additional 2 years. So those individuals need to come forward and timely apply. And if the application is received one day later than October 5th, 2017, the immigration agency is going to reject it outright. And it's so very important as we're looking at Congress to make the fix that we get people in as much extended status as possible.
And so when we think about, in particular, Illinois, I want to ask you, just last week, Governor Rauner signing the Trust Act, which limits how much local police can help federal authorities enforce immigration law. Before we get to the Trust Act, let me just ask you really quickly, are you concerned that the Trump administration, come March, if nothing else happens with Congress, will start targeting DACA recipients and Dreamers will start being deported?
Of course. That is a major concern, and it's not hyperbole. The memos that have come out of the Trump administration have said anyone who's undocumented is more or less a priority for the Trump administration in terms of removal from the United States. So while the FAQs, and I don't want to sort of sound the alarms, but I want people to be educated and know the direction that we're in so that if they want to advocate with Congress to pass a fix, this is the time to do it, because there's no more sitting and waiting and, oh, it's not going to be that cruel. We're now seeing the cruelty in action, so we can't just sort of close our eyes and just hope that the worst isn't coming. It's in our control to speak out and, you know, tell Congress what we're looking for. So, yes, I'm extremely concerned about that. An FAQ that came out from the Department of Homeland Security said that they're not going to immediately start to proactively target DACA individuals whose work authorization or whose DACA quote-unquote status expires. But if they find themselves within the crosshairs of the immigration police, their case can be evaluated for immigration court and then ultimately removal from the United States. So there's not going to be sort of any special, well, you're an expired DACA, so we're going to give you special consideration. I think undocumented individuals in the United States are a priority under this administration for removal.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Michael Jarecki and Nancy Ramirez-Blancas about DACA. As always, your comments are always welcome. You can give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21STShow. Stay tuned. Hang with us. We're going to pick up this conversation just after this short break.
The 21st is made possible in part by Krannert Art Museum at the University of Illinois, presenting the School of Art and Design Faculty Exhibition on view through September 23rd. More information is available at kam.illinois.edu.
I'm Nyla Budo, and you're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. We're talking about the announcement yesterday by the Trump administration that it will end the DACA Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival programs, something that likely could affect some 42,000 or so people right here in Illinois who have qualified, young people who have qualified for that program that was created by President Obama 5 years ago. We've been talking about the DREAM Act. Senator Dick Durbin, again, the author of the original introducer of that, who this morning is saying that he's taking this before Congress again. My guests are Michael Jarecki. He has an immigration attorney based in Chicago, where he's also with the Chicago chapter of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. Michael, you were talking about the very real fact just before the break that you think very clearly deportations could begin for people whose DACA protection expires in March. Of course, that's if Congress doesn't step in and have a fix before then. I wanted to ask you about here in Illinois. Just last week, Governor Rauner signed the Trust Act that limited how much local police can help federal authorities enforce immigration law. One provision states that state law enforcement can't arrest someone solely because of their immigration status. There's other provisions of the law that say that a warrant has to be issued by a judge before local authorities go look for people. How much do you think that state law will make a difference here for DACA recipients should there be no fix come next March?
Yeah, I mean, these provisions are extremely important in that local police, in building connections within their communities and trust within their communities, aren't going to be seen as immigration law enforcement. And having that divide is extremely important in protecting immigrant communities because we want immigrant communities to interface with the law enforcement in their communities. If somebody witnesses a crime, we want those people to come forward and help to solve that crime. If people are victims of crimes, we want people to go to their local police and know that there's a safe place for them and that in reporting a crime or reporting something that has happened to them, they're not going to then be turned over to immigration law enforcement at the federal level to be deported just when they're coming to interface with local law enforcement. So it's an extremely important progressive piece of legislation that has been passed in Illinois, and I'm really proud of the governor for signing it last week.
And is there a concern also, as this has now been announced, that you think people may not show up for work in terms of jobs? Like, people may be worried about going to their place of employment?
Yeah, there's that, and the other sort of component is if somebody is ticketed for something and they have to show up to a courthouse, we have heard things across the country where immigration law enforcement has sought to put people under arrest even when they're going about their everyday
right, like that happened
trying to be law and order.
Sure, that happened in Champaign-Urbana a couple months ago. We had another attorney on the 21st talking about that.
Exactly. So that's problematic. But when there is fear instilled in the communities and the wrong information gets out, of course people are going to change their behaviors to protect themselves and to protect their families. I think this is the point that this should not happen in Illinois and that local law enforcement aren't going to be deputized to do the federal immigration agent's work. And that's very important. And this is the way of Illinois saying, Attorney General Sessions, if you say DACA is unconstitutional and we need to enforce the Constitution and we need to do things lawfully, this is the state of Illinois saying, well, we're going to do things lawfully when it comes to immigration detainers and warrants that they need to be issued by a judge, and we are not going to honor pieces of paper that are just issued by immigration law enforcement.
Nancy, as you think about you all are doing at the University of Illinois, you're president of the organization Illinois Coalition Assisting Undocumented Students Education. What are you guys doing in the immediate future? You have plans for a rally today?
Yeah, we do have a plan for a rally today called Action to Help DACA Undocumented Students, where we're asking the University of Illinois to put pressure on our congressmen, on our leaders, to really put some type of legislator or passing of the access bill, which has been stalled since January of this year. And at the same time, we've put together a form of resolutions that we will present to the administration in the hopes that they would continue their efforts to help us graduate, really, and to give us the resources that we need now that due to the canceling of DACA.
Yeah, well, that's Nancy Ramirez-Blancas. She's a senior at the University of Illinois, studying psychology and pre-law. I should mention, certainly, the University of Illinois President Timothy Killeen did put out a statement yesterday expressing his concern at the Trump administration's actions. We'll put that on our website, 21stshow.org, and we'll tweet that out as well if people are interested in what the University of Illinois has already said about that. Nancy, thanks for being here. I want to thank Michael Jarecki as well, an immigration attorney with ILA. Mike, Nancy, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning into the 21st. As we've been hearing a lot lately about the death and devastation caused by several major natural disasters, whether we're talking about in the United States and around the world, 63 people in Texas lost their lives as a result of Hurricane Harvey, still reeling from flooding there. There's more than 1,000 people who died last week in South Asia as a result of heavy monsoon rains and severe flooding there. And there's more bad news on the horizon. Yesterday, President Trump declared a state of emergency in Puerto Rico, Florida, and the U.S. Virgin Islands because of Irma, the Category 5 hurricane, strongest on record ever recorded in the Atlantic, that's on track to head to those areas. People of all ages struggle when it comes to processing all of the bad news we encounter every day. But if you're a parent, you're faced with the additional challenge of how do I explain all of these things to my kids, especially those watching all of these natural disasters unfold on the news. To discuss this, I'm joined by Dr. Corey Cross, a spokesperson for the American Academy of Pediatrics, a pediatrician at Children's Hospital LA. Dr. Cross, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Also on the line with us from Peoria is Tara Haley. She's a freelance scientist, science and health journalist. She recently wrote an article for Forbes magazine, for Forbes Online, 8 books to help children understand disasters and cope with anxiety. Tara, welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, thank you.
Dr. Cross, let's start with you. You're in L.A. It's just having conversation. My sister lives in L.A. and she's in Burbank where they are all of the ash from wildfires, 105 degree temperatures you guys had over the weekend, certainly in California. You all have also been close to all of these sort of natural, maybe not disasters, but pretty bad situations. And I just wanted to ask, this can be pretty confusing and scary for young children. And I wonder what parents should know about common reactions children should have when they maybe are frightened by news that they're seeing on television or other places.
Absolutely. So it's gotten to the point where we really can't protect kids from what's going on. You can make sure that you're not watching news with graphic details and images while they're awake or while they're around. But you bring them to the grocery store or just hanging out with their friends, even kids as young as 4, we know have a sense when a major crisis has happened. And so you can't shield them for everything, so you have to make sure that you don't just ignore it, that you actually talk to your kids about what's going on, and you talk to them in a very clear and straightforward and direct way, and that you take a moment first to ask them what they know. So the best way to start those conversations is, what have you heard? What do you know about this? And if there are any questions that they have, and then you answer their questions as straightforward and directly as possible. And then you go from there to see what other information they may need or they may want. And different kids are very, very different as to how they process, scary events in their lives.
Right. So obviously, from your perspective, you think you don't wait till your child comes to you. Parents should be proactive about these things right now.
Absolutely, because when they come to you, they've already heard it from somebody else, sometimes a kid, sometimes they just pick things up, on the news that they sort of hear when they get in the car, maybe you're listening, and you don't even realize what they know, and their information is often sort of garbled up. And so just say, something bad's happened, there was a flood, there was a hurricane, and it happened here, and then you say that's very far from us or that's near to us, what is it that you've heard about this? And then they'll tell you and they'll ask you questions and they'll usually ask you why. Why did it happen? Because kids like to ask why. And you don't have to feel like you have to give a reason. You can say, I don't know why it happened. But what I really feel is it's good to redirect the kids towards, this is what we can do to help. I feel like they always have all this energy, and children are so wonderfully natured by just they have those big hearts. And so we want to refocus them into doing something good so that they don't feel helpless, because that's the worst feeling for kids, is this helplessness. So how can we help? And what can we do? And that often makes it sort of dealable, tolerable for them, because they feel that they can do something better.
Tara, your recent article for Forbes includes recommendations for several children's books that can help children understand natural disasters. Why did you decide to focus your article on different books?
A couple of reasons. First of all, we're from Texas, and my 7-year-old has picked up on the fact that it took us 2 days to convince his great-grandfather to leave Rockport, where the Category 4 hurricane hit directly. And so we were having to go through exactly what the doctor was just discussing in terms of like addressing his questions. And, he had a couple nightmares about things and just trying to say, what's happening and reassure him that everybody in Texas that he knows is safe and all of his grandparents are safe and all of the rest of it. And then I have a lot of friends in Houston, including one friend in particular whose house flooded about 4 feet. And he has 2 boys about the same age as my boys. And I was thinking, what can I do to help? Like, I'm up here in Illinois. And then I realized, well, my area of expertise is in books and in looking at, how to help parents know what experts like the American Academy of Pediatrics say. So I started researching it and looking for books. And I did that because books are a really wonderful way to do something physical. It's one of the best activities you can do with your child is to read with them. And it lets you have a discussion as you go. There might be things that children are thinking about, but they don't even consciously realize that they're thinking about it. And then you read the book together and they can ask questions and it sort of draws them out a little bit. So, and a lot of the books that I mentioned are books, there's quite a diversity of them on there. And it's interesting because one of them has the same title that the doctor just kind of mentioned in a way. It's called A Terrible Thing Happened. And what's so genius about it is that it never tells you what the thing is. It just talks about this terrible thing happened, and it doesn't even matter what the thing is. It discusses, you know, the main character couldn't sleep very well, and he wasn't feeling good, and his tummy hurt, and he wasn't hungry. So it helps normalize for kids the way that they're feeling isn't weird. That's a normal reaction to fear, and we can talk through that and address that and then try and take proactive steps to, you know, alleviate that fear.
Tara has a great list of all of these books that she mentioned, not just A Terrible Thing That Happened, Flood by Alvaro Villa. Dr. Cross, I wanted to ask you, as Tara's saying, I wonder how important it is for parents to convey to kids not only that it's okay to be scared, that this is a normal emotional response, but how much should parents share their own fears or concerns? I guess, again, I imagine that's also an age-appropriate and child-appropriate decision.
Yeah, that's true. I think that it's important two things. For parents to realize that if they feel that their kid's having a response that they think is too strong or not necessarily appropriate, that if your child is telling you that they're afraid, they're actually afraid. So even if you think that it's for an unnecessary fear, you need to address that. And then I think that one of the best ways is for parents to talk about it, for them to talk about how they feel, you know, saying something like, you know, this makes me sad too. Sometimes when I'm sad, you know, I don't feel like eating so much, or sometimes I get angry about things that I shouldn't be getting angry about. Do you ever feel that way? And then, you know, what do I do when I'm angry like that? Sometimes I have a cup of tea, or I do this. And, you know, what could you do to make yourself feel better? Those are the ways that kids learn. It's called modeling. And we model that behavior for them and we talk through it. And I agree with Tara. I love the book, A Terrible Thing Happened. And I think it really is, that's another way. So we can model this behavior. We can talk about the behavior. But then little kids, I mean, even school age kids, third and fourth graders, they don't always have the words to talk about how they feel. And when you use a book, you can say, have you ever felt this way? What did that, would they do? Should we do that? And you can really facilitate that conversation.
Dr. Cross, do you think if anxiety or stress your child experiences becomes very severe, what kind of action do you recommend parents take?
So if you start noticing that your kids are having sleep problems, falling asleep, staying asleep, nightmares, if they're having stomach aches, headaches, basically just these vague complaints or changes in behavior, so regressive behavior where they're bedwetting when they didn't used to, or they're having trouble with separation anxiety or acting more immature. If you think these things are becoming more severe or carrying on longer than you expect them to, that's when you need to talk to your pediatrician, or if you have a mental health provider that you really like. But I would start with your pediatrician, and they can walk through with you what you can do to sort of alleviate those concerns and if you need to actually talk to someone.
Tara, we don't have time to talk about all of these books. They're great recommendations that you pulled together. I just wanted to ask you about your top recommendation. It's actually a book with no words, Flood. I mentioned it before. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah. What I thought was so wonderful about it, first of all, it follows exactly what's happening to the kids in Houston right now. It portrays a family that, you know, is preparing for a major storm that happens. They leave. And then you see the flood, you see the water, you know, crash into the house and fill the house. You see the family come back. They see that the house is destroyed, but then they start rebuilding. And at the very end, you have the family living in the house again and happily going about their lives. And I think what makes this book so valuable right now for these particular disasters, for Harvey and possibly for Irma, is that it, first of all, it's an experience the kids can relate to, but not just the kids. My grandmother-in-law, who just was left Rockport with her husband, has severe dementia, and it can be used for older adults to go over what happened to help them understand. And it can go for people who have very limited English, for parents who don't have good literacy skills, who are very low income. You don't have to read anything; all the pictures are there. So it's the most accessible kind of book there is, and it ends with a note of hope. It ends with this idea, look, this happened, it was bad, we're all okay, we're all here, and now we're going to rebuild, and we're going to be able to make a good life for ourselves.
Yeah.
And you don't need a single word to say it. So it crosses
thanks
all language
that.
Boundaries. It helps mm-hmm. three-year-olds. I mean, it's...
Yeah, it, thanks for that, Tara. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but I want to thank Tara Haley. We will put the link to her story. I want to thank Dr. Cross as well. And of course, you can stay tuned to the station throughout the day for the latest updates on Irma. Thanks, guys.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Some 2 million Americans have lost an arm or a leg, whether it's in an accident or in battle or through sickness. Many people can't afford advanced prosthetics, which can cost thousands of dollars. But one Illinois company is working on a bionic hand that could be both smarter and cheaper. The company, Psionic, used special pressure sensors to make prosthetic hands actually give amputees sensory feedback, something almost like the ability to actually feel again. And they're trying to do it in a way that can be affordable. Joining us now in our Urbana studios is Psionic co-founder and CEO Adil Akhtar. We're also joined by retired Army Sergeant Garrett Anderson. He's from Gifford in Central Illinois. He's one of the first people to use Psionic's prosthetic hand. Adil, Garrett, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thanks for having us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Garrett, you're also a master's student at the University of Illinois studying rehabilitation and counseling. You've used a number of prosthetics. Can I ask what's different about this one from Psionic?
Well, the difference between this and other prosthetics is with a standard prosthetic, you have to do a completely different action to open and close your hand. But with the Adil's algorithm and hand technology, if I think about opening my hand, think about closing my hand or pinching, I just have to think about doing that motion, and it does that instead of doing something completely different.
Wow. So, Garrett, I know you lost your right hand. Was that was back in 2005. Is that correct?
Yes, that's back in 2005.
When you were in the Army, your truck was hit by an improvised explosive device in Iraq. I can't imagine how many different prosthetic devices you've used since then. Can you describe what it's like to actually be able to experience that sensory feedback for the first time?
I guess
more than a decade, right?
Well, yeah, it just gives you the sensory of knowing exactly how much pressure you're putting on something. I can remember when I got my first prosthetic, and I almost broke broke someone's hand because I tensed up and it kept squeezing and turning at the same time. So at this point, you'll know to release or anything like that, or you can hold something without that hesitancy to actually harm something at the same point.
Well, and even I imagine like picking up a cup or something like that would be, you kind of know how much pressure then, mm-hmm. I guess, to put on it.
Yes. Well, if you grab the water bottle with a standard prosthetic, you would just squeeze it and all the water would shoot out the top. But with the Adil's prosthetic, I could squeeze it to the point where I know it's going to hold and still not actually eject the water out of the top of the water bottle.
That's Garrett Anderson. He's a retired Army sergeant. As we were talking about him using this prosthetic device from Psionic, let's go now to CEO Adil Akhtar. Adil, so this company, your company, you're the co-founder. You built this technology that offers, as Garrett's explaining, this ability to have that sensory feedback. Can you explain? I don't know if there's an easy way to explain how this works, how the hand works, how it's able to do this.
Yeah, for sure. And so in the fingertips, we have just standard barometric pressure sensors. So these sensors are in your cell phones, your GPS devices, and they normally measure the air pressure. And what we do is we actually inject silicone and rubber into it instead, and that converts it into a highly sensitive touch sensor. But we can do it for ultra low cost because these sensors you can find anywhere. When we detect that pressure, we can actually then stimulate his skin to feel like a tingling or a vibration or sometimes even pressure. And we relay that information to him so he knows exactly how much pressure he's applying on the object.
When you say stimulate, how? How does that work?
So, okay, when he controls the device, we record the voltages coming from his muscles. And this is kind of like the opposite of that. To give him the sensory feedback, we actually send current across his skin.
So, Garrett, how does it feel? Does it feel like a little tingle, or how does that work?
It's like a minor taser. It's like a minor like tickling or tingling on your skin. It's not painful, but you still know it's there.
Okay. And Garrett, is there anything in particular you're able to do now with this prosthetic hand that otherwise you think before were impossible or extremely difficult?
Well, I think the big one would be is that if I held my wife's hand or my daughter's hand with my right arm that I used to have, I can actually know that I'm holding their hand and how much pressure I'm putting on their hand. Prior to that, I just have a metal hook, and there's just only way I know is if they're pulling on it or anything like that. So I think that is a groundbreaking thing there, that you actually can tell that you're touching someone's hand. So you're getting a full experience of the prosthetic and still not losing touch with being human at the same point.
Yeah, that sounds like that sounds like an incredible thing to be able to have that again. Garrett, can I ask, when you said like before, did you have a hook before for your hand?
Well, I got hit in 2005. I still use a hook on a daily basis until we can get Adil's product ready to go. So I use a hook on a daily basis. And the prosthetic hook has been around since World War II, so the design hasn't changed since World War II. But this prosthetic by itself, being that old, still costs around $14,000, $7,000 to manufacture and get to someone.
So $14,000, I'm sorry, is how much the cost of the hook costs?
Of the arm, the prosthetic, and the hook, and the, to get it to
Why is
patient.
It so expensive? Do you know? Is it just something because it has to be individually fitted for each person?
Yeah. You can't go to, like, Aldi's and buy a prosthetic arm. You kind of have to have each one made for each individual. So each socket's going to be individual. Each mechanism is going to be different for every amputee. I can't pass mine on to somebody else because every residual limb is going to be a different product.
Adil, you mentioned that the goal of this is to make this affordable, not just as, Garrett's talking about kind of the different prosthetics that he's used. First of all, you said, is this made out of plastic? I wonder what you guys are doing to try to keep costs down.
Sure. So actually, it's made out of silicone and rubber are our primary materials. And the thing is that a lot of the $30,000 bionic hands that are out there right now, they're made out of these rigid, hard materials, and they break all the time. So we've talked to dozens of clinicians and patients, and the number one thing is that the fingers break because, you've had too much impact on the sides. So rather than, make our hands even more rigid and solid, what we did is we went the opposite direction. That's more like the human hand. Because when you hit your human hand, it complies, right? You hit your hand from the side and it gives. So we decided to make our fingers out of this flexible material, out of polyurethane rubber and silicone. So you can hit these fingers with a baseball bat and they survive the impact, but we can still develop it for a super low cost.
And how much is that? How much is that super low cost?
So it's actually a tenth of the price of, or a tenth of the cost of the $30,000 hands, what they're being manufactured for. And our goal is to have this completely covered by insurance companies in the U.S. so it'll be at no out-of-pocket cost to users.
And so when we first talked to you guys, Adil, about a year and a half ago, when you were just kind of, we were just getting kind of a sense of what the company was. I wonder how close you are now to being able to manufacture this hand sort of out of the testing phase. As Garrett says, he's just been able to sort of test it on an occasional basis.
Yeah, and so we actually spent the last 2.5 months in Shenzhen, China, which is the electronics hardware capital of the world. And we did that primarily to identify motor manufacturers for our hand so that the hand will be twice as strong, twice as fast, and will last up to 2 years. So in the next coming months, we should be ready to have Garrett able to do home trials with the hand and actually, put it to the test on a daily usage basis. And also with our partners with the Range of Motion Project in Ecuador, we'll actually have a couple of these hands down there for testing as well.
And what's that project? What's that project to do in Ecuador?
So we collaborate with this nonprofit organization known as the Range of Motion Project, and their whole mission is to provide a more equitable distribution of prosthetics to those who need them worldwide, which aligns very much with our own mission of developing the hands for people who need them. And so we've been down to Ecuador 3 times, where we worked with a man who lost his arm, his left arm, right below the wrist, 35 years ago due to a border war between Ecuador and Peru. And he was able to do motions with his hand that he hadn't been able to do for 35 years, like make a pinch and then feel from it. And so he felt as though a part of him had come back. And so we plan on working with him and other patients down there in the next coming year as well.
And you said home trials. What kind of things are you going to have Garrett do to make sure this works the way it should?
Well, basically everything that he would normally do on a daily basis.
So, Garrett, as you've been testing it out, are there things that you have found with the device that you kind of feel like, oh, I wish this would be better? Or are there things that you feel like it's working pretty well?
Well, yeah, every time we do testing and stuff like that, I'll be like, well, if we could tweak this way or if I could do this. Durability is going to be the biggest thing, I think. So I've expressed that. I want a durable hand because if you have an arm that's pretty but it's not durable, it's useless to me. So we want it durable and useful at the same time. So, you know, working with Adil and his team has been great and eye-opening for me. But just to be able to, for me to put my input on how I can benefit other amputees, it's been an amazing journey for me also.
Yeah, how did you guys meet? How did you guys end up working together?
The university actually put us together. They were filming a commercial for, I think it was during the football games, and they knew that we had a hand, and they knew Garrett personally, and so they put us in contact.
So that's Garrett. We're speaking with Adil Akhtar. He's the CEO and co-founder of Psionic. He's also a graduate of the University of Illinois. He's a PhD in neuroscience and a master's degree in electrical and computer engineering, both from the University of Illinois, where Garrett Anderson is also a master's student in rehabilitation counseling. He's also a retired Army sergeant. Garrett, you said that you about the prosthetic device that you obviously like looking pretty. Durability is more important to you. But what does it look like? I'm curious.
It looks like a standard hand. They made the hand that, you know, the same size as your original hand would be, or and the arm's going to be the same length. So everything's going to be exactly the same. It's not going to be the same color as your skin because that does nothing for me. I want something that's going to be durable. So they try to do other prosthetics companies try to do cosmetic hands, and those just aren't as effective. But you need something that you're willing to use every day, and that's practical. Because if it's not practical, it's a waste of time. So that's the biggest thing. We need something practical and that's useful at the same point.
And Adil, this is actually also a little smaller, right, than an actual hand, and you did that on purpose?
Yeah, and so the vast majority of hands that are out there are large and bulky and sized for like 75th percentile males. And so ours can be sized down as small as a 50th percentile female, and we can make it bigger as needed.
Mm-hmm. Adil, why do this? Why dedicate yourself to making an affordable advanced prosthetic when you have a PhD in neuroscience and a master's degree in electrical and computer engineering?
Well, so this has been a lifelong goal for me because when I was 7 years old, I actually met an amputee for the first time. And I was visiting Pakistan for one of the first times I could remember. And she happened to be my age. She was missing her right leg and using a broken tree branch as a crutch. And at the time, I had wondered, you know, we have the same ethnic heritage. Our parents are both from Pakistan, but we have such vastly different qualities of life. And since then, that kind of spurred my interest in this. And as I grew older, I realized that this was due to a lack of resources, be it healthcare, safety, and financial resources. So I wanted to, it's been a lifelong goal of mine to develop prosthetics for the entire world.
And so I guess from that standpoint, Garrett, I wonder for you, how can you explain to sort of the folks listening what impact you think it would be if there was an affordable and effective advanced prosthetic limb like we're talking about hitting the market here?
Well, I mean, like many people can't afford prosthetics. I'm in a very fortunate state that the military pays for mine. Some people go without just because it's such a burden or an expense for them. And insurance companies deny them. But if you can get one under cost for the insurance companies and the individuals, then more people will have accessibility for themselves. And accessibility is the biggest thing for anybody with disabilities, starting at the University of Illinois. Accessibility is the standard in which we want everyone to have.
Adil, what's where are you guys at in terms of what's your time frame for hopefully bringing this to market?
So we plan on going undergoing FDA approval in the next year, and we're hoping that we can get it covered by insurance by the end of next year so that by early 2019 we can get this to people who need them.
That's Adil Akhtar, the CEO and co-founder of Psionic. I want to thank him as well as Garrett Anderson for joining us to talk about this new prosthetic device that Psionic is developing right here in Illinois. Thanks, guys. Thank you so much for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today. As always, all information about everything we've talked about today is at our website, that book list that we talked about earlier. You can go to 21stshow.org for that. You can also go to 21stshow.org to find directions for how to find past shows, whether that's on iTunes or Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find as well. You can ask her to tell NPR1, if you have that enabled, to play the 21st. All of that information is at our website, too, as well as ways to contact us via phone, email, or how to follow us on social media. We're produced by Christine Herman, Alan Montesilio, and Bob Hawley. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm broadcasting today from the downtown studios in Chicago of Medill School of Journalism for Northwestern University. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.